and the air is like the insulator.
Right, right. And it goes round and round. And if we look at page 4, Aaron 4.
Okay, I'll just load that up.
We see some more of these storm pictures, and then I show pictures of Tesla coils. And you can see the similarity.
Absolutely. You can see basically we have a large area at the top and a stem, and the charge on the Tesla coil, I understand, builds up on the top, and we have the central column as a coil.
And the strike ring, down below, and there's a picture of Figure 5 of a tornado with lightning bolt actually going down. And I think we all know that with hurricanes and tornadoes, we have lightning bolts. And on 9/11, folks would be surprised to learn this, there's reports of thunder at most of the airports right around Ground Zero. JFK Airport, LaGuardia, the one in Newark, as well as the smaller ones out in Long Island. I'm working on a new page where I have those listed. Maybe we can cover that tomorrow.
Okay,
that'd
be very
interesting. But there's rain and thunder reported at, JFK. That's, right close by. So we have these, the storm is acting like a big coil.
Exactly, and I think there's a couple of things which I'd like to get to. The first point I think I'd want to make is that we've already spoken before about the Hutchison effect, which we'll probably do a recap on that at a later point. But basically, the Hutchison effect started with a set of experiments, which was with Tesla coils. So we're seeing this commonality here in the idea that the storm has an electrical discharge and a charge separation, which is exactly what you get with a Tesla coil.
Correct. And we also know that from electrical coil, we can make a magnet. And from a magnet, we can make electricity. You can go either way with that.
That's right, and I mean, if you take a magnet and you move it around inside a coil, it will generate an electric current. It's called through a process of inducing an electric current in the coil inductance, and vice versa. If you put an electric current through a wire, it will generate a magnetic field around it.
Right, and if you look at Figure 9A and 9B, one's electromagnetic induction, and then you have electromagnetism. That's which way you're going. So they can switch back and forth, depending on which way it's going. So they're related. And if we start, further down the page, some comparison with the Hutchison effect, but perhaps we might go to page 5, Aaron 5, at this point.
Yes, and this is perhaps, I think, the most interesting page of all. And I would say... arguably the most important data, some of the most important data that you've managed to collect. And I found this pretty astounding, really. So, yes, if you'd like to go take us through this, please, Judy.
And this one deserves a lot of time. If we start out at the top, there's a picture, figure 2. We have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different measurement points, but the only 6 of them were working that day, of where they record the Earth's magnetic field. They have magnetometer data they've collected. And I'd like to point out in this first table timing for various events. WTC-1 got its hole at 8:46 in the morning. WTC-2 got its hole at 9:02. WTC-2 goes poof a minute before 10. WTC-1 goes poof about 10:30. And at 5:20 in the afternoon, WTC-7 goes poof. And if we look at those particular times on the chart of magnetic data, we can see a blip in the chart for each one of those events. We can see a change in the chart happening coincidentally at that moment. And how far away is Alaska from New York City?
Well, I measured it on a map that I've got, and it's about 3,500 miles.
That's pretty big distance.
Yeah, that's in a straight line.
It's like, bigger than the width of the United States. And then some. And if you look at the charts, right, it's figures 16, 17, and 18. They're not numbered correctly yet. The yellow charts.
Okay.
There's the up and down magnetic field, the east and west magnetic field, and then the out of plane.
Yeah,
three
so if you just
components.
Explain that a little bit, there's components of the magnetic field which act in a north-south direction. And
magnetic
north, yeah. Yeah, and a component which will act east-west, and then a component which acts into the ground and out of the ground.
Correct. And if we look at these charts, it's for several days leading up to 9/11, not much activity. It wanders around, there's some noise here and there. And then just before the North Tower gets its hole, you see the curves start to diverge, and then they take an abrupt turn right at 8:46 a.m. and start back the other way. So how'd the Earth's magnetic field know that something was going to happen to the towers and anticipate it? That's sarcasm.
So this is it, and this is a very, very interesting point of data, and it's one, when we first discussed this a good few weeks ago, I noticed the dip which appeared when the first hole appeared on the building, but this, I didn't really notice this dipping beforehand. And again, we have the music coming up here, so I'm just going to say this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling in for Jim Fetzer, who's here on the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett's here on Monday and Friday. My guest is Dr. Judy Wood, and we will be speaking some more about this very important data after the break.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song.
Good evening, this is the Dynamic Duo, and my name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm speaking with Dr. Judy Wood, who's my guest for today, and she'll be speaking with me again tomorrow at the same time, normally you would find Jim Fetzer here, but these two nights I'm filling in for him, and on Friday and Monday, you'll find Professor Kevin Barrett, and we're talking about 9/11 and Hurricane Erin, and some of the most important data that Dr. Wood, I think, has gathered. And if she could continue where she left off with the magnetometer data from Alaska, and there are some very important features of this data.
I'll try to get the figure numbers renumbered roughly by tomorrow, except I'm still building this page. But the yellow charts are the furthest zoomed out, and it covers 4 days span. And you'll notice that all three measurements are pretty still. There's a little bit of noise here and there, little things happen, right up until just before the North Tower got its hole.
And we're on Erin 5 on drjudywood.com. And which figure is it again, please, Judy?
It's figure 18, the third yellow one it shows. But if you scroll down further, you get more zoomed-in looks, and you can also click on the diagrams, and a bigger one will jump out. If you go down to, there's a blue set, and there's the pink set, then there's a purple set.
Okay.
The purple set is the most zoomed in.
Okay.
And next to the green set on the right. And between those two, you can see that first blue line, that vertical blue line, that's when the North Tower got its hole. So you see a change in the magnetometer values leading right up to that moment. And especially in the H set, that's figure 10, H5 and H4. That's the purple and green pictures.
Okay.
You see an abrupt change, a kink in the curve, right precisely at the time they say the North Tower got its hole.
And this of course, means that something was going on before the tower
got its hole.
This is the really significant thing, which is easy to miss. Something was affecting the Earth's magnetic field just before the tower got its hole. So, you know, you have to ask the question, if you are going to be curious and you want to look for more evidence, what caused the change in the magnetic field? Now, I'll just, you know, point out that we've already mentioned previously the Hutchinson effect. And one of the things which, you know, we perhaps haven't covered so well is that this idea of the environment having to be charged up before the effects take place. So my, you know, my view on this would be that that is the process that, you know, you are seeing with this dip in the field.
Right. The magnetic field is changing. And maybe things get in equilibrium later, or maybe they don't. And other aspects we can talk more about tomorrow, give folks time to look it over carefully between now and tomorrow, that from the time that the first tower got its hole until Building 7 went poof, things were in disarray, and then they changed at the moment Building 7 went poof, as though that was intended to bring things to an equilibrium, but it didn't quite do that.
And there was something very interesting that you know, it's kind of obvious, but when you described it to me, you know, a few days ago, I thought it was very interesting in terms of the mode or the direction of destruction of the towers and also the direction of the crashes or supposed crashes.
Right. We have a hole that appeared in the north tower going north to south, then a hole in the south tower that went south to north. Two towers went from top to bottom. Then we have one tower that went from bottom to top.
Yeah, so, you know, there is this kind of weird reversal of directions, you know, associated with the events. Now, of course, we don't know whether that's significant or not. All we can do is note it as a point of data and try and correlate it with other data that, you know, you've been collecting.
Right, that's all we can do is just keep looking and keep your eyes open and keep thinking. But patterns like this seem, you know, to me really strange. What a coincidence that the Earth's magnetic field did something strange right before the towers got their hole, right while they're going poof. I don't say collapse, I say go poof, and they turn to dust, they turn to powder in a relatively short amount of time. We don't know if this is a cause or an effect or totally unrelated coincidence. I think that's pretty far-fetched, especially seeing that they didn't want folks to know about the hurricane and didn't advertise it, that it was in town. But there really appears to be a correlation, that especially that first hole in the North Tower, that V-shaped cusp right at that moment.
It really is very difficult to imagine what else would cause that. I mean, you know, I think it was one of our friends, he pointed out, you know, does a plane crash change the Earth's magnetic field 3,500 miles away? I mean, you know, it's just extraordinary to think of.
Correct. It's, you know, do car crashes cause a change like that in the magnetic field? Do other plane crashes? You know, I haven't seen a plane crash that does that.
I think, you know, it's becoming very clear to me, Judy, from the data that you've collected so carefully over the last few years, that, you know, we're getting a better idea and understanding of, you know, what actually happened at the World Trade Center complex. And really, you know, for people to continue to talk about, you know, it solely being the result of explosives or thermite or this, you know, type of thing, it really doesn't. It explains probably less than 1% of the actual data that you've collected, you know, and I'm really feeling now that we're building up towards something here with this whole set of data that you've built up.
Like the parking problem, the cars who accidentally parked upside down.
Well, this is it, and, you know, and some people have said to me, well, a lot of this is all based on very, you know, detailed science, and you have to understand physics. And I've had people say this to me when I've talked about this. And, of course, you know, some of the things that we've spoken about tonight, yes, well, maybe, you know, that's true. But, you know, as I've said, there's no one that I've encountered so far who have difficulty with understanding that what the correct orientation of a car is.
Or that the building's gone.
And that's another one. You know, we can pick on a number of points of data like this, and you know, really, this is the research challenge, if you will, that people have to explain this data in some other way. If it isn't to do with field effects, if it isn't to do with the Hutchinson effect, if it isn't to do with you know, this unusual idea of levitation of materials and objects, then what is it to do with? If somebody has got a good, you know, correlation with the data, then let's hear it. Let's hear it. And I think probably at you know, some point we're going to talk about some of the sort of opposite aspect of that, in that what we're not hearing anyone trying to explain this data. All we're really hearing is a lot of noise, basically, about various topics which are largely unrelated to any evidence.
Or saying that yeah, Judy Wood is stupid, or you know, or
exactly.
Judy Wood is a shill, or that doesn't address the data.
Exactly, and this is really, you know, and I mean, I've just been amazed that you continue to find you know, more aspects of this. And I think going, if you'd like to take us down, you've got some further down this same page. You've got a, I think we've got a few minutes left here, probably about 3 minutes left. So we might have to cut this off, and I'll just say at this point we will be continuing tomorrow with this. So the topics that we haven't covered today, we'll probably do a quick recap tomorrow and then continue. But if we go lower down this page, Jude, I don't know if you can just mention some of the charts you've got there with the very spiky-looking charts and what this was relevant to.
The ones way down at the bottom, got magnetometer readings, general ones from various hurricane seasons. And just looking at what happens with hurricanes, and you notice, you can tell looking down the list, they're chronologically ordered top to bottom. You can see when the hurricane season starts, the values start roaming around the page.
Yeah, so if you go down to about figure 37, well, here I hear the music, so we've run out of time. We will be back at the same time tomorrow. I'd like to thank Judy very much indeed for coming on tonight, and and I'd also like to thank everyone for listening. And we'll speak with you again tomorrow. Good evening and welcome to the Dynamic Duo. Now, you'd normally find Jim Fetzer hosting this program on the middle 3 days of the week, and Kevin Barrett would be hosting on Mondays and Fridays. Today, however, I've been asked to guest host, and my name is Andrew Johnson, and through the marvel of transatlantic communications, I'm talking to you from the UK. Now, many years ago, I set up a website, and I used to get a lot of email about Andrew Johnson, who used to be one of the US presidents, so that's something I have in common with one of your fellow countrymen. Before I introduce my guest for today, I'd like to start by reading out a few things which seem particularly relevant to our discussion. One quotation I recently heard courtesy of our guest tonight is this expression: to acquire knowledge, one must study, but to acquire wisdom, one must observe. And that was stated by Marilyn Vos Savant. I've also had a message sent to me recently when I notified this person I was going to be doing this dynamic duo tonight. And he wrote to me that, what we're going to be talking about is 9/11. And in relation to this sort of issue of 9/11, which has been talked about many times on this program, of course, my contact said to me, when governments try to hoodwink the masses, we must examine all of the evidence available. Only then will the truth emerge. In examining the evidence, we may find things that are incredible, unpalatable, unpleasant, or even fantastical. If the evidence presents them, then we have no right to reject them. Otherwise, we will be making ourselves into the very propagandists that we say we are opposing, lopping away all the bits we don't want to see, and making patterns out of what's left. I have been shocked at the degree to which some in the 9/11 truth movement want their truths cozy and reassuring rather than real and simply based on evidence. For example, whether there were planes or not, the stark vehemence with which so-called no-planers are attacked suggests that there are those crying out for truth who actually want only reassuring truths. Let's not tie each other up in dogma and limitation. Instead, let's look at the evidence as honestly as we can. If we are truthful, then we can walk 10 feet tall and bulletproof because we don't have a party line to uphold, just an unfettered desire to discover the truth through evidence. And I think an unfettered desire to discover the truth describes how our guest, Dr. Judy Wood, has tried to approach her study of 9/11. And I'd like to just check that I've got Judy on the line with me now.
Yes, I'm here. Hello.
Fantastic, fantastic. Very
Thanks
pleased
for having
that
me.
We're speaking tonight. Now, I'd also just like to sort of follow on from that little introduction with something that was also sent to us this week. And it really is about, in relation to looking at the evidence and finding out what seems to be impossible initially, but when you look at the evidence, you actually find that it isn't impossible. And indeed, it seems to be what has actually happened. Now, this person said, when you have excluded the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth. This person then said, I've had to exclude planes as impossible. All four of them, and this is on 9/11, of course, I've eliminated conventional demolition as being also impossible because the top of WTC-2 clearly disappears before our very eyes in the videos. Watching a skyscraper vanishing in real time, I'm not entirely surprised that this utterly improbable truth has been investigated in depth by only one researcher, Dr. Judy Wood, in her intensely insightful observations of the vast amount of photographic evidence provided by various authorities. And I think also what I'd like to kind of put into the mix here, obviously Dr. Judy Wood's background has been in the academic establishment, you know, for quite a number of years. And one thing that I came across about 5 years ago for the first time was from Eisenhower's speech in February 1961 in his leaving address to the nation. And he said at that time, today, the solitary inventor tinkering in his shop has been overshadowed by task forces of scientists in laboratories and testing fields. And then Eisenhower went on to say, a government contract becomes virtually a substitute for intellectual curiosity. And for every old blackboard, there are now hundreds of new electronic computers. And Eisenhower then said, the prospect of domination of the nation's scholars by federal employment, project allocations, etc., it poses a danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific and technological elite. So really, with those words, which Dr. Judy Wood and I have discussed a little before now, I'd like to go over to Dr. Judy Wood and ask her what really started her on the sort of road to 9/11 research. And I think we've now got the break coming up, so I think what will be easier for to do is to come back after the break, and we'll get Judy to tell us what her experience has been. And this is Andrew Johnson on the Dynamic Duo, filling in for Jim Fetzer, and we'll be back after the break.
Visit GCNlive.com today.
And we're back now with my guest on the Dynamic Duo, Dr. Judy Wood. You'd normally find Jim Fetzer in the hot seat for the program, but I've been asked to fill in for him. And my name's Andrew Johnson, and I'm in the UK. So I'd like to go back to Dr. Judy Wood. I only just managed to catch her briefly in the first segment, and I was asking her how she first got into doing 9/11 research, and so we shall try and pick up our discussion there.
Well, like everyone, you hear about things happening, and someone turned on the TV in the faculty conference room, and we all went in to look. To me, it didn't look right. Buildings don't unravel like a sweater. And I looked around the room, and everyone was in this trance, just mesmerized by it. And I'm looking like, somebody's put a joke on us. This is the War of the Worlds joke, I decided. And so I went up to my office and called my mother on the telephone, because she lives real near the Pentagon. And that was one way of checking, you know, my theory, if this was a War of the Worlds joke, because if she lives near the Pentagon and the Pentagon is being attacked, shouldn't we have fighter jets overhead? She looks out, no fighter jets. So we both decided that it was a hoax.
Really, that's interesting. I you know, I've not heard you, in the time that we've spoken, I've not heard you tell me that particular interesting story. So what really, you know, what sort of set you going on the path of research?
Yeah, and then after that, I went down to the faculty conference room, but they all looked at me like, what kind of an idiot did we hire? And you get the sense that you're supposed to shut up. While I was up in my office, I did this quick, you know, parallel analogy of billiard balls, which I think most folks have seen now. It's on my website. But I mentally went through this exercise to see what kind of time you'd expect the towers to, you know, disintegrate in.
And how long was it after the event that you actually went through that, either that mental exercise or you actually wrote something down? Was it, you know, the day after or?
Oh, that was right then. After I finished talking with my mom, I went through this, you know, exercise mentally and did some quick calculations. And then I thought, well, maybe I have the wrong value of the coefficient of gravity. So I checked my physics book to make sure I remembered it correctly, because, you know, something's wrong with this picture. And that was correct. Well, maybe that's a typo, and maybe I should check another book. And I think I checked 3 or 4 books.
Wow.
And I felt pretty confident about what I had calculated. Went back to the conference room, and they're still mesmerized. And that's when I got the strong feeling that, you know, we can't talk about this. Something weird was going on. So I was hoping that somebody else was taking care of it, you know, the grown-ups. Because I wanted to keep my job, and it was very clear that, you know, I was on probation, kind of, you know, new faculty, that you don't want to stick your neck out too far.
Absolutely, and I think this is really, you know, this ties in precisely with what Eisenhower said in terms of much of the research now in universities is, you know, funded by the government at some, you know, level. And this is what is preventing a lot of people from speaking out. And, you know, for yourself, I think you're one of the extremely rare people that's actually, you know, spoken out and done something about it, which we'll be discussing later in the program. I'd also like to add at this point that I'm hoping that Dr. Judy Wood will be with us tomorrow evening, where I will also be hosting the show. And we've got quite a lot to discuss, which we'll be getting to shortly. And I think, Judy, when we mentioned how you became involved in the research, and, you know, you also told me that the election played a role in things, and if you'd like to sort of discuss that.
Well, when I was thinking that grown-ups were going to take care of it, you know, I'll just do my job and, you know, keep my nose to the grindstone so I can get tenure and all the goodies. And after all, when the 2000 presidential selection went belly up, the Florida vote didn't look like it got counted correctly. Folks said, well, we're going to take care of it by the next election. You know, that kept people from finding the errors in the previous one. Okay, well, they'll do it right next time. Well, on election night and the wee hours of the morning, when it's the same thing repeated with Ohio as the last time it was with Florida, at that moment, I realized that they weren't going to fix it and that somebody had to do something. And it was my job as an American citizen to step out. And especially what got me was I think it was Edward said, in the wee hours of the morning, every vote counts and every vote will be counted. And then I think it was by 10 a.m., Kerry is throwing in the towel.
Yes, I mean, I was also following it, not extremely closely, but well enough to be very puzzled by Kerry's reaction in the 2004 election. And he, you know, the way I described it to people was he just rolled over and played dead. You know, it was really strange.
I had a class to go to right after that to teach, and I felt the need to apologize to my students. There's something that our generation failed.
And really? So what did you say to them at that point, if you can remember?
I don't remember exactly, but it was, to me, it didn't matter, you know, it wasn't so much who wins the election. It was, if we're going to have a process where votes get counted, let's count the votes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, it seems to be that a lot of things, such as the vote counting, have, I mean, there's so many things which seem to have been subverted in the last, well, since 9/11, basically. And we'll probably talk a little bit about some of the things which have impinged on what, you know, you've been doing and how some of those things seem to have been really changed in character since 9/11. I think probably, you know, the question on one or two people's minds, and I do know you wanted to sort of bring this up early on in the discussion, was, you know, we've known Jim Fettes for quite a long time, and, you know, I'm hosting this program tonight, and believe me, no one is more surprised at being asked to do this than I am. And I think really we might want to just discuss exactly why it seems to have happened this way, you know, and why, you know, I think the last time you were on, with Morgan Reynolds, I think that was, what, a couple, 2-3 weeks ago? And so why there hasn't been an intervening point where you've you know, come on with Jim Fetzer?
My work is about getting the truth out.
Yes.
And about exposing the truth, and if it doesn't come out in any other way, that concerns me.
Mm.
And it seems that when I've been on with Jim Fetzer, folks have referred to it as Wood and Fetzer's research.
Yeah. Well, we hear the music again. Yeah. I think we'll come back to this point after the break. And this is the Dynamic Duo. My name is Andrew Johnson. You'd normally hear Jim Fetzer during the middle 3 days of the week, Kevin Barrett on Mondays and Fridays. And we'll talk again after the break. Andrew Johnson, and I have on the line with me Dr. Judy Wood. And before the break, we were discussing actually why Dr. Wood has decided to come on the Dynamic Duo today to speak with me, and we were talking about the research that she's been doing. So if you could carry on from there, please, Judy.
My interest is in the truth, getting to the truth, regardless of what it means, let the chips fall where they may, and exposing the way I see things, you know, looking at the evidence. And I just want to look at the evidence and not worry about what it concludes, because we need to figure out what happened before you figure out what it means. And it's so easily distorted, and it seems that various folks try to take ownership of my research.
Yes.
To distort it, the meaning of it and where it is going. You know, like on various forums, they refer to Fetzer's and Wood's research. And
yes.
I don't know how Fetzer has anything to do with my research.
Yes, I mean, I've seen this a lot, and of course, what we've both experienced is various messages which have been, you know, I mean, you've got your email address posted on your website, and anyone can use it to contact you, but we've repeatedly seen messages have come through, you know, to you from somebody else, which is always very strange, you know, when one email address is as easy to use as another. So,
right.
So, you know,
and,
I think
why,
also the
why,
point...
And Fetzer has been invited to present my work, but then it's not presented quite right. He refers to lasers, masers, and plasmoids. I don't think I use any of those words.
No, I mean, I've noticed this, that if you go onto your website, you talk about directed energy weapons, and you don't use any of those words.
And my specific definition of directed energy weapons is the most general. It's energy that is directed and is used as a weapon. I don't know the name of this gizmo. That is what I call it. It's energy that's been directed and it's been used as a weapon.
Yes. And I think what we've also seen from various other camps is it's the kind of straw man approach, in terms of they will invent a term which, you know, they use to describe your research, which you've never used, and this makes it then, you know, becomes essentially a way of, you know, denigrating your research. You know, I think we know the term that we're both thinking of here.
Correct, space beams.
Space beams or ray beams from space. And people start to band this term about as if you've said it, and you never actually have said this.
And I've never said where the gizmo or components of it were located, or you know, what the serial numbers were, or the manufacturer, or anything about it.
That's right, and I think people seem to, sometimes I think it's just an honest mistake that they get mixed up, but people who are focused on research, not necessarily scientific research, but factual research, should be able to determine the particular, you know, vocabulary that's being used to describe something. And we, I think we've seen this as a repeated theme where they're just very careless with the vocabulary, and you have to, after a period of time, ask yourself what, you know, why this is true.
Yes, by design. And it's interesting that there are particular words in a list that get used a lot. And it sort of identifies the source. But I have not said what was used. I've eliminated things that could not have done it. Now, I didn't say bubble gum was not involved. I didn't say there was no bubble gum in the building. Just that, you know, bubble gum isn't capable of turning a 500,000-ton building into powder in 8 seconds.
Yes.
And, you know, I've gone down that kind of list, but also have defined different characteristics that I've seen. And what was pretty interesting about this whole path I've taken, I didn't know that such a thing as directed energy weapons existed, but the data told me it did.
This is the point, isn't it, which I think some people miss. And obviously when you posted certain conclusions on your website, then people, you know, try to attack well, I mean, in some cases, you haven't posted actual conclusions. I mean, I've got to be careful what I say here, because I've said certain things, you know, which I try and make it clear when they can only be attributed to me, you know, and I'm sometimes guilty of not always making that clear. But nevertheless, you know, I feel so strongly about some of this evidence that you've done such an amazing job collecting, and how it's kind of tied in what I've been studying for the last 5 years, that I perhaps sometimes go a little bit too far occasionally. But nevertheless, I think, you know, to go back to the point of evidence, that is really the focus of what we want to talk about primarily, is the evidence for
and something my favorite question I just have to ask here. Looking at the scene of after the event on 9/11, you have to ask, where'd the buildings go?
Yeah.
And more importantly, why haven't any other people been asking that question?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think that goes right back to how such of the events of 9/11 have unfolded, and the way that the reaction to them has been. It's really, you know, arrested people intellectually.
Yes, that folks can't observe it. Now, that's not a difficult question to ask. It doesn't take a lot of background. It just takes independent thought. You can't be a trained monkey and then say, where'd the building go? Because that wasn't how our citizens were trained.
Yes.
And they're trained by, you know, all sorts of means. And, you know, if someone had planned 9/11, don't you think they would have planned to cover up with it? You know, they're not going to do something like that without a cover-up. So what would the cover-up look like? It would be leading folks astray away from looking at the data. So let's ignore any other input and just look at the data. And then, boom, you start seeing things.
Absolutely. And really, then it goes back to the evidence and collecting all the evidence and trying to make sense of it. And I've heard it said repeatedly by people that I know, Judy Wood just puts out speculation, which is totally untrue, because what you put on the table is a vast amount of evidence. And I just, you know, wanted to say at this point that, you know, your site that you put together, it's got so much evidence and so much material on there. And really, a lot of it doesn't really need any translation into another language, because it's mainly pictorial in nature. So anybody speaking any language who, you know, looks at these pictures, I mean, it's very easy to see some of what you're saying. For example, as you say, the lack of a building. That's not a technical thing. The building is either there or it isn't. You don't need a technical qualification to identify that.
One of my favorite pictures is of when the people came out of their hiding places right after the second tower went away. Their postures say so much. You know, arms folded, arms at their side. You can see their mouth is gaping open in shock. There was a big building there. Where'd it go?
Yeah.
And there's, you know, paper on the street, but other than that, no other debris. And they're just in shock. Why did folks quit asking that question and quit observing other things? So maybe we could see what else we could observe. Any new observations?
This is the key to unlocking what actually happened, and I think, you know, the study that you've been doing over the last few years has really taken us onto a whole new level with this. You know, and I know we've spoken at length before, and I've said to you that I really, you know, there's so much evidence that you've put on the table which has made me aware of so many things which I wasn't aware of a few years ago, and it's really changed my opinion completely of what happened on that day. And we hear the music again, so we're coming to another break. My name's Andrew Johnson. This is Dynamic Duo. My guest, Dr. Judy Wood, and I'm filling in for Jim Fetzer. And we'll be back after the break.